This is Fresh Air. For about 10 years, we've heard NPR's Deborah Amos reporting on conflicts around the world. She covered the war in the Gulf, the Iran-Iraq war, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the crackdown in Tiananmen Square. Long before the Gulf War, Amos deepened our understanding of the Middle East through her astute political coverage and her moving stories of men, women, and children living there. Now Amos has returned to the States for a one-year leave of absence. She will be a Nieman Fellow at Harvard and has already begun work on a book. Today and tomorrow, we'll be talking about some of her experiences covering the Middle East. First, I wanted to know why she decided to take a leave of absence.
You know, it came because one morning I woke up and I couldn't remember whether the Soviets had withdrawn from Afghanistan first or the Palestinian uprising had started first. And it woke me up and I couldn't remember. I just couldn't put the sequence of events together. And I thought, okay, this has been too much. You really need to stop for a while. And so I decided in February to apply for a fellowship. I was fairly desperate by February. It was after the air war had started, and I knew that I was close to burnout, that I just needed a break. And I could make it through when I knew that I was going to get a break.
How often did the urge to get a real break come in the previous years?
Not very often. It was incredibly exciting, and it never stopped. I had a job that was classified as a fireman, and I used to call myself a news Bedouin. Instead of having a beat where you had the ebb and flow of a situation, I went to the hot spot. So it never stopped. And while you would get tired, it was so incredibly exhilarating and exciting. It was really hard to imagine giving it up, although that came to an end in the Gulf War. That was so compelling, so overwhelming and overpowering, that I frankly knew it was time to take a break and just think about it.
Now, let's talk a little bit about, you know, reporting during the war. You have to report under the pool restrictions and the other press restrictions. Now that the war, you know, has been over for a while, and you've had a chance to really reflect on those restrictions, where do you stand on them? How much do you think that they were harmful? Do you think that they served an important function?
I've had two major thoughts about the restrictions. I do think that they were harmful. I think what they did was dilute the coverage. There were no high moments. There were no low moments, but there were no high moments. I think at some moment towards the end, the military saw us as the historians, and they had blown the chance. There were not enough of us in the places that we should have been if we really were the historians of this battle. And I think that they kept a lot of information away from us that was not detrimental to their warfighting capabilities. But I'll say something else that I've really thought about a lot since the war, and that is, you know, it's always said that generals fight the last war, but I think in this case, reporters were reporting on the last war while the military was fighting a war of the 1990s. I don't think that we understood what was happening, because most of us aren't Pentagon correspondents. And even those of us who are tend to focus our coverage on congressional hearings where a helicopter doesn't work or a tank doesn't work or they spent too much on a toilet seat. And so the really important concepts, military concepts, that were being tested out here, we didn't understand and we didn't report on them. The whole sense of a new military doctrine that was introduced in the late 80s, I don't think we understood about the military buildup to this war, the 10 years since the Carter Doctrine said that we would defend the oil fields militarily if anyone tried to take them over. We didn't understand military policy directed towards Iraq in the last year. And so while the restrictions were loathsome, and I think that people in higher positions than mine should battle this one out with the military, I think that there's also a problem on the journalist side about what we knew and what we were reporting about.
Did you ever violate any of the Pentagon press restrictions?
Yes.
Can you tell us how?
Early on in January, there was an Iraqi attack on the Saudi city of Khafji. Now, the reason that we found out about it is because a wire service called from Bahrain, called the hotel in Khafji and got Iraqis on the line. And that's how we knew that the town had been attacked. So the pool system was a bust. It didn't work. The military waited for more than 12 hours to tell us about it. And we were furious. And we went to the commanders who ran the Joint Information Bureau in Dahran and said we wanted to go. And we were all on, pools. And this was the whole point of the pool system. And they called the Marine commander up there. And he said, no, we've got enough people up here. There were journalist pools up there. They didn't have a clue what was going on. And so a group of us, there were six of us, decided that we would get in a car. We wore our best military fatigues. As a British colleague of mine said, you had to look rufty-tufty. You looked a little dirty, and you threw some dirt on the side of your four-wheel Jeep, and we evaded all of the Saudi roadblocks, and we got about 5 kilometers outside of Khafji. Now, we stopped on the side of the road, and a Marine colonel gave us an on-the-record interview for 45 minutes, and what we found out was that part of the reason the battle was taking so long is there was a Marine reconnaissance unit inside the city. So they couldn't do a whole lot until they got those guys out of there. Now, nobody knew about this. So, yes, I broke the rules. I got a good story out of it. I didn't risk anybody's security. And it was the only time I did, because very shortly after that, the air war and then the ground war started, and there was really no time to do that kind of thing. And there wouldn't have been a good reason to do it, because to find out, to break the rules, you would have had to drive into Iraq. And one of our colleagues had done that, and we knew what happened to him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Amos, and she's been with NPR for many years. She's on a one-year leave now. She covered the war mostly from Dahran, and also she was in Kuwait just right after it was liberated. She's been reporting from the Middle East for about 10 years. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. NPR reporter Deborah Amos is my guest. She's on a one-year leave from NPR after covering the world's hotspots, especially in the Middle East, for many years. What was the military's conception of National Public Radio, and did that affect the access that you got?
Yeah, it did. It was great. The military listens to us, the Air Force in particular, and the Marines, because they get it on Armed Forces Radio.
Oh. Well, all things considered, or all things considered in Morning Edition?
All of it. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, a lot of people knew who I was. And it made access excellent. I spent an entire day with the head of the Marine Corps in Saudi Arabia, Walter Boomer, who let me do that because he's a public radio listener. And I would be out. There was what's called a force-on-force exercise, and that means a bunch of tanks rolling around. And the other colonels kept saying, who is that? And General Boomer would say, that's Deborah Amos. I've always been a big fan of National Public Radio. It was amazing. And it also happened after the air war, much to the dismay, I can assure you, of my commercial colleagues who brought the matter up with Pete Williams. They said that we were the same as the Tobacco Times, and the reason that the military was dealing with us is because we were real easy on them. I mean, it simply wasn't true, but there was some jealousy over the fact that we did have, I think, better access than our commercial colleagues. And I was very, very pleased by that, that the military does listen to us.
That's really interesting. was there ever information you had during the war that you didn't want to report for ethical reasons, that you thought that this information was true, but that it might endanger the troops?
No. The only time, of course, is at the beginning of the ground war, where I did know everything that was happening. I could see it on the map. Now, I was in contact with...
What do you mean you knew everything?
I could see it on the map. I knew about the left hook, the surprise left hook, where we had forces that went into the western desert of Iraq.
You saw it on the military map?
I saw it on the intelligence map.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and I knew that. Now, every day, I could get on the telephone and talk to Neil Conan, who was our correspondent in Dahran. And I couldn't say what I knew. He was still reporting. He was reporting off the briefings that were coming out of Riyadh. And I had to be very careful about what I said, because I did know, and it was too early to really report that. So, yes, I think that would, I guess, be in the category of a time where I didn't say.
If you could have given him information without going on the telephone, would you have let him know?
Yeah. But there was no way to do it. What I wanted him to do was ask me questions, because he would say, gosh, I can't figure out why such and such is happening. And I would say, I know.
Right.
But it was, the situation was such that it never occurred to him that I would know. And there was no way I could say, Neil, I've seen it on the maps. I've been in the intelligence room. I've seen everything. So maybe it was just as well that there was only one of us who had to really, you know, make those decisions about, no, I can't report that.
And you would have wanted to give him the information not so that he could have reported it, but so that he could have been there and seen what was happening?
Well, so he could have understood what was going on.
Right.
Because, look, we knew that we were in a process where we were going to be reporting the end of this war for the next couple of months. The faster you understood what the strategy was, the easier it would be for you to figure out what kind of questions to be asking.
Right.
I mean, Neil is a responsible journalist. He would know better than to say, they're all sneaking up the west side and they're going into Iraq. The point was to tell him what the strategy was so you could make some intelligent guesses on what was happening and you could judge independently. You see, that was what was so difficult. We were so dependent on the military to give us our judgments. Was it going okay? Was it fast enough? Were the troops fighting well? How did we know? Because our information was all controlled by the military if you were outside the pool system. I was on the inside and I could see everything.
Deb, why did they let you see these intelligence maps in the first place?
Because I think that they knew that they had control of us. We were in the pool. So they could monitor all of our reporting and they could stop us giving out the secrets. On the other hand, they also were sophisticated enough to understand that we did need to know that. We were going to be reporting on this war for months to come. We might as well know what happened. You know, it was important for us to know exactly what happened.
What was the most difficult time you had getting to a phone to file during the war?
Kuwait City. Kuwait City was a nightmare, and Kuwait City changed the rules of reporting. The game used to be that you had to get there first. Now you have to get there first and you have to get to a telephone. And if you didn't bring one with you, there weren't any in Kuwait City. Now, on the first day, I drove up from King Khalid Military City and into western Kuwait. I stopped at a place called the Ali Salam Air Base. And there, the Saudi 20th Brigade was there, and there were some Americans there. And the place had been, quote, liberated about 12 hours earlier. I had come up the desert in an incredible drive, seeing, you know, shattered tanks, seeing the Iraqi oil trenches. Now, what was I going to do with that information? There were no telephones. Lo and behold, the BBC shows up, and a colleague of mine, Brian Barron, says, do you want to use the phone? So I could call out on that first morning simply because I ran into him. And we made our phone calls in the front seat of a four-wheel drive, and I could call into London, and London could relay that information back to Washington. I hit Kuwait City, same problem. The city was incredible, but there was no way to report it. So this time it was the BBC again who did have a satellite phone, and I spent that first day out in front of the British Embassy waiting in line to first get on Sky Television's phone and then to get on the BBC. And every day it was the same story. You could get the story. It was what the military would call a story-rich environment. The problem was the telephone.
What was the riskiest situation that you were in during the war? Where you felt the most physically in danger?
You know, it's very interesting. There was only one time throughout the entire war that I felt myself in physical danger, and that was the first night of the air war. And I had gone downstairs to make a broadcast when we knew that the air war had started, and at some moment, the alarms went off in the hotel. And I ran back up to the room to get my gas mask, and we all piled down into the basement. And we got through the first one, and that was all right. And then we had about a 20-minute break where everybody came back upstairs. The telephones weren't back on again, and the alarms went off again. These were very loud alarms that went out all the way through the hotel. This time I was a little smarter than the last time. This time I brought a radio with me because I didn't know how long we'd be down there. And so we trooped back down into the cellar. I was in, you know, my chemical mask, and I had my radio. And I remember that Armed Forces Radio was broadcasting ABC news. And I heard Peter Jennings say that Israel had been hit by a chemical weapon. And somehow, in my mind, it was like the end of the world. It was the worst thing I could think of. And what my fright was about is that I didn't know what was going to happen next. Now, within an hour, we knew that that wasn't true. And from that moment on, I settled down into because I knew what was going to happen next, I felt somehow safe. I mean, look, this is my fifth war. So I had been through much scarier times than anything that happened to me in Dahran or even in the desert.
Gee, you know, it must have been a little like one of those lifeboat-type movies. You know, a lot of people alone together on a life raft, a great psychological drama. Here you were with all these reporters who, some of whom you probably knew very well, some of whom you probably didn't know at all, and everybody was thinking that they were facing possible death. It must have really been some psychological...
Yeah, there was a lot of hand-holding, I have to say. A lot of hand-holding downstairs. But then you were also in your own private space because being in that gas mask, you really couldn't talk.
Right.
So I could see them, and as I said, there was a lot of hand-holding, but we really didn't say much to each other.
NPR's Deborah Amos. Tomorrow, in part two of our conversation, we'll talk about what it's like to be a woman journalist in the Middle East. This is Fresh Air.